out last March. Tell you a little bit about the background, why I focused on this particular person. Was not a merchant back in the middle of the country. Then talk about his strategy for economic development, which brought him a great deal of fame in his own time in the late 1850s, all the way up until his death in 77, and discuss mainly the dilemmas of that policy. That is, there were certain logical flaws, or certain tensions in that policy. And so I think it places the whole history of Russian industrial thought, Russian entrepreneurial activity in a very interesting light. And then thirdly, I want to mention briefly some of the ramifications of the of this story for the present day, whereas you know, capitalist institutions have weakly developed in the overpowering influence of the state is still very much so although Chizhov has been a very neglected figure, and I'm going to compare him, contrast him to a Japanese industrialist who is actually revered by many people to this day, I think his story, even his failures, the story of his failures, have some relevance for our current thinking about Russian economics. Okay, so let's start with then the focus on Chizhov. He was a member of the gentry, and he belonged to a group of people at the University of St. Petersburg, and in the artistic circles in Rome, where several Russians lived, including Nikolai Gogol, who were entranced by the idea of romantic nationalism. That is, the 1830s, 1840s, the Germans, the French were all looking at their history and making claims for the uniqueness and the extra moral character of this or that people. So the Slavs started doing that too, and Chizhov got very much interested in the special nature of the Slavic soul, the world of religion, the destiny, the role of the Slavs in world history. And in that sense, he was a minor Slavophile thinker. I must say, when I took Professor Petrovich's course here at university, when we got to the Slavophiles, I thought these people were very strange indeed. How could intelligent people think that every society is self-contained, that there are certain kind of moral principles that live on century after century, that everything in the West is terribly bad, and everything in Russia is wonderful except for serfdom, which needs to be. And so I came out of that experience thinking that Slavophiles were kind of clowns. They were very interesting, they were artistic, but their ideas seemed very, very strange. And then it so happened that in the course of looking at merchants, I found that their best friends and their allies were Slavophiles. So a couple of decades later, there I was coming to Slavophiles. So the importance of Chizhov is that he left a diary. He started his diary just before the December Revolt in 1825, when he was 14 years old, and he made the last entry in his diary the day he got hit from a heart attack at the age of 66. The diary has 3,952 pages in it, handwritten, and very few scholars have bothered to use it. So we didn't quite know what to make of this Slavophile nationalist, friend of Gogol, capitalist, and they basically did very little. My first trip over, I still remember, so I've been to Russia four times, I was able to obtain part of the diary on microfilm prior to 1870-73. Officially, my topic on the Russian merchants ended in 1870, so I was pushing the law a little bit. I soon realized, though, after I got back and started looking at this is a goldmine for information about entrepreneurial history, because here was a member of the gentry who was involved in railroads and banks. And so I went back in 1980 hoping to get the rest of it, but our colleagues sort of didn't know what they are. They told me no, I had looked at it 9 years before. Somebody else is working on it, et cetera, et cetera. So I couldn't get the other part of the diary, the part from 1825 to 50 and from 1873 to 77 until 1996. So when I went back again, we managed to get the rest of the diary, and on the basis of that, I was able to put together the whole story. It really wouldn't make sense to write the biography of these major parts of the document. So it is, in a sense, a biography. It's you know, based on the thinking and the activities of one person. But this person was the central driving force for the whole group in Moscow who were using nationalist ideas, setting up banks, railroads, setting up steamship companies, that kind of thing. So it's all there in the diary. You know, all I had to do was to read it. So I was able, by using the diary, to understand what his strategy was, his political views. He had some very costly things to say about many people. And he gave what is really interesting for historians, unflattering portraits of some that were not criticized in public. After he died, he put a 40-year seal on the diary so that even his friends couldn't read it, and he insulted his friends as old men out of here. And of course, in November of 1917, when the seal came off, there was a major revolution going on, so people weren't flocking to the library to find out what Chichov had said. I'm a little bit uneasy using biography to talk about grand economic trends, but and this is the first time I've ever attempted anything like a biography. But I think the diary is so rich that it's worth mining it for the order it contains. And it really, I think, is a way to build a bridge between sociology on one hand and biography. And business history. Okay. So although it is really business history, and it came out in the business history series of the business school at Harvard, I think has a lot of greater ramifications. Much of business history, by the way, is a biography of a great organizer who sets up a major factory or mix of great innovations. And a lot of it is quite positive. You study the great man and his business allies to tell the story of what succeeded. In this case, it's pretty much a failure. But the failure, I think, is the biggest. Okay, so let's look then at his strategy and what he tried to do and why that strategy had major problems. Chichov really decided during the Crimean War in 1855 that something really had to be done. The war was going badly. Russia had been invaded. The army and navy couldn't even defend themselves on Russian soil. When the Tsar died, Nicholas. And so many people were ready for major changes, even government too. Launched what's called a series of great reforms, so-called great reforms, which took place from 1861 to 74. So the goal was to take the talent that existed, and there were, I think, trained engineers and economists, and of course a whole lot of merchants who had been involved in business for decades. Take these people and organize them for the basis of a Russian national economic policy. In 1857, a major railroad company was set up called the Russian Railroad Company, but its headquarters was in Paris. It was funded basically by the Jewish bankers, Emil and his brother, Mikhail. And many Russians felt that the French were just keeping milking the country and spending lavishly and refusing to hire Russian engineers, and it was a great, a little different crime. So the idea was to amass whatever capital was in Russia, stay away from the foreign bankers, get the economy rolling in new industrial pursuits, financing things through new banks, and building railroads, which of course were very much needed at a time when Europe already had a whole network of railroads in the 30s and 40s. And then put high tariffs on domestic industry so that the population in Russia would pay a little bit more for the textiles and the leather goods and even machinery. but this would give work to Russian businessmen, provide stable prices so that we wouldn't have to buy all this equipment in the West, and enrich the West. And essentially, this policy was going to come into being by initiating a dialogue with the government. The word glasnost, which was very popular in Gorbachev, came to power in the 1980s, actually was very, very important in the 80s, 50s and 60s. A lot of people were clamoring for glasnost, and the Slavophiles, who seemed to be kind of wildly radical nationalist dreamers, in fact had a very clear program of opening up a dialogue. And it was they that often suffered much more than the customers in censorship, which of course wasn't all that much interested in open dialogue. So this was a fairly coherent strategy. Chichov collected some money from friends and eventually from merchants, and he launched a very large industrial journal that went for 2.5 years. After that journal failed because the merchant didn't keep up the payments, he launched a weekly newspaper, which kept going, 52 issues a year for several years. And then when that failed, he linked up with the great Slavophile journalist, Ivan Aksakov, and edited the economic portion of Aksakov's newspapers. So there's a whole train of journalism. Chichov is writing article after article calling upon people to follow this rather clear program of economic nationalism. And in fact, the title of the book was going to be Fyodor Chichov and Russian Economic Nationalism, but that didn't sound like the title of the business system, so we told him to find something a little more glamorous. Well, anyway, the key concept here is what I've called a Slavophile capitalism. It's really an oxymoron for those who know what Slavophile stood for and what capitalism is, but I think it shows the effort, the goal that Chichov was trying to accomplish. That is, Slavophilism was, of course, a rather complicated philosophy of romantic nationalism that we can't really talk about in great detail here. But Slavophile capitalism attempts to take the key ideas of Slavophilism and put them to service for this economic nationalism. Okay? So we have the notion of paternalism and community. Just as the landlord is a good father to his ignorant and illiterate serfs and wants to help them, so too the merchant, the Moscow merchant especially, will hire peasants in the factory and make sure that they have a clinic and a school and a daycare, along with the 12-hour day, 16-hour day. All right, so they're very paternalistic. Okay, it's very self-congratulatory. Okay. Also the idea of communities. Now, we're not just hiring and firing people, we are creating a whole community. And that's very much romantic nationalism. So it's a community in the factory, okay, so that the merchant, who is generally quite religious, very Orthodox, shares the same religion as the people, as the workers that he's hired up as peasants, and they all can feel the same way about the law, Christian law. Okay. And the evil in the world comes from Europe, where everything is much too legalistic, impersonal, where people are treated just as commodities. Okay, so this is going to be a good kind of capitalism, because it's based on the love that Russians have for one another. Okay. And since Russians make up half the population, and in Moscow, it's much more than half, this is a very ethnically based kind of capitalism. Now you might say, capitalism has nothing to do with ethnicity, and I'll give you Max Weber's six points about capitalism in a minute, but Chichov is trying to work this together. Okay? Then there's the xenophobic notion. We already talked about how much they hated the French people who were in charge of the Russian railroad company. All of the major trading firms in St. Petersburg were run by Germans or by British people. They could never trust the Poles, of course, because they were constantly rebelling. And so this is a matter of taking Russian economic destiny in their own hands, building up, say, by tariff walls and other exclusive policies, a Russian economy for the Russians. Okay. And it appealed then to that kind of primitive patriotism that Russians are known to have looking out at the war. And also, because the Slavophiles have been extremely xenophobic. I mean, what Slavophiles said about Germans, compared to the Ukraine, very legitimate, very vicious. Okay.
So there was that xenophobia, patriotism, and contentment. And then, of course, the Slavophiles love the Tsar. This is what makes Russia neat. But they want the Tsar to listen to them and engage in this dialogue. Okay? So if the Tsar will open up his ears to the voice of the people, who will never want political power and are, of course, no threat to him, then the state can be the great paternalistic force that guides the society forward, just as the gentry landlord or the Russian merchant in his factory is the paternalistic force that looks after the people. See, so it's a whole kind of hierarchy of Christian love and trust. So we would never ask for power from the Tsar. We don't want a constitution at all. A constitution would be the worst possible thing. The constitution is based on distrust. Contracts are based on distrust. I don't trust you. I signed a piece of paper. But if we love one another, then we can trust one another. So just as the child trusts the father, so the serf should trust the landlord, and the worker should trust the... And they, of course, look to the state, because the state had enormous resources. It was the state who would raise the tariff barriers. It was the state who would help give subsidies. It was the state who would organize these things. So the hope was that the autocracy would listen and then adopt this policy of kind of ethnically based capitalism, and then start discriminating against foreigners, you know, against non-Russian, against Jews, Armenians, Germans, and Poles, who are the foremost active ethnic groups besides Russians in the corporate world. Okay, well, that's the plan. That's the plan. Now, you're already figuring out that this plan is full of problems. Because we need to know what capitalism is. According to the classic definition of capitalism, which I think is still valid, by Max Weber, whom Baron Timur was called the last great sociologist. Mm-hmm. Right? Capitalism has six major features. One is that your economic activity is based on calculation. And you make rational decisions, generally involving investments of large amounts of money. Secondly, there's modern technology involved. Third, there has to be some kind of legal structure that will at least protect private property. Right? The market should be open to anyone, regardless of ethnic background, and also regardless of social status. So in Russia, there are all sorts of social status groups that can or cannot do certain kinds of things. The idea is that as an individual, you should be able to move from here to there. Okay? Labor market should be free. That means no slavery, no serfdom, no labor unions. That is, the price of labor should be set by the market. And then finally, these are going to be large enterprises, and so that involves the public state of shares, implicitly as the stock market. Okay. Well, that's, I think, a pretty good definition of capitalism. It means that there was no capitalism in ancient Rome. There were the beginnings of capitalism in, say, Western Europe in the 15th, 16th, 17th centuries. We have the trading companies, etc. But, you know, if we look at Russia, we can just say not much. Certainly, Peter the Great didn't wait for merchants to get involved when he wanted to build a cannon factory, just move people around almost on a capitalistic manner. Well, anyway, some of these elements, though, were borrowed by Chichov and his friends. They had a set of corporations, they had a set of banks, but they did so because they felt that it would all work to the advantage of the group. So they were Chichov and his friends would travel to Europe. You know, they actually ordered their locomotives from Borsig in Germany. They borrowed quite readily from this, always, however, in the hope that the essence of their Slavophilism would never be tainted. Now, it doesn't take very long to figure out that there are certain logical problems. Okay. So let's look at the way that this program was or was not carried out. Basically, it failed. It was very hard to carry out, and I'm going to put primary responsibility on the state. But I think ideas are really quite flexible, but the state did a lot to block the realization of this policy. Okay, so here then are the dilemmas. And when I say that there are dilemmas of Russian capitalism, right now I'm talking about dilemmas of Slavophile capitalism. But there are any number of different strategies in, I suppose, the top 10 cities or regions of the Russian Empire. There's the German area around the Baltic, there's the Poles, there's things that are going on in Baku,
Ukrainians are beginning to wake up in Kyiv. So this is kind of a case study, but I think you can find similar dilemmas in other places. It's just that nobody has done that kind of empirical statement.
Okay, obviously the logical tension between calculation and the labor market, treating your labor as a commodity, conflicts with the notion of paternalism and community. Chizhov thought that he had this problem solved because the Moscow merchants were such wonderful Russian patriots. After being involved in business with them for a while, he began to write some very caustic comments. They can't be trusted, they don't understand the law, I will never go into business with this guy Kokarov again. You can't be trusted. So he lost his faith in the merchants' paternalism, but he also saw, I think, eventually that these principles are really quite individualistic, legalistic, and they're really the opposite. It's like Gemeinschaft and Gesellschaft. Just two very different species of political and social organization. But because he was a patriot, he thought that he could carry on this notion of selfless activity. And he himself was remarkably immune to greed. He'd been very poor most of his life. He thought himself a multimillionaire. He said, I'm going to give it away. He worked hard, even though he didn't need the money. He actually criticized the merchants for going to the opera too much. Himself and Mamatov was always at the opera, not looking at the railroad. Okay. So he, I think, understood that it was possible to blend these two together, at least in a lifetime. Okay. And he never really admitted the tension. But I think it's pretty clear that there was this logical. The next thing on xenophobia is really a problem, because if you're damning Europe for being the source of all evil, then you have to buy your locomotives from Borsig, and you have to get Baring Brothers to give you a loan so that your railroad will go, that's really a problem. So he basically combined his most vicious attacks to the French. The French couldn't be trusted. But Baring Brothers, I could do this with Baring Brothers, in fact, you got a big loan. And Hope and Company in Amsterdam, was British banker. So it turned out that he needed a lot of foreign technology, a lot of, not so much expertise, he could find engineers, but certainly the capital was not there. Russia was simply too poor a country, and the government, of course, helped make the problem worse by refusing to allow banks to go through. So when you needed cash, you needed a loan, the friendly British bankers were there, and actually, throughout the course of his career, he developed a good working relationship with British bankers. The problem is it completely undercuts the notion of xenophobia. You know, how can you build this perfect society based on hatred of the West if you're really depending on the West for your technology and your finances? So that was a real problem. Again, he didn't admit it because he felt he was a trust, his better judgment. Actually, he had lived abroad for many, many years. He spoke Italian fluently. He could read French and a little bit of English. Times is money. He actually went to England a couple of times looking for railroad equipment. So if we could pin him down, we'd have to say he'd have to admit that there was this problem. But he didn't really make that. The real problem for him, the worst of the dilemmas, was the problem of hypocrisy. What do you do if the government doesn't help you out? What do you do if the government doesn't follow your plan? You really can't criticize the government because you love the autocrat. This is the whole basis for Russian exceptionalism. And although much of the historical literature paints the Russian state as a major force in industrialization of the country, and that's true, if you see the story from this point of view, of a businessman who's trying to get things done and has to wait for months for permits, and he has to deal with some pretty dishonest and incompetent bureaucrats, then there's a real problem. Okay. Paradoxically, he did get along very well on a personal level with one of the most accomplished of the ministers, the Russian imperial ministers, finance minister Reuter.
on whom a dissertation was written by Oliver Hayward, who was my TA. It's a wonderful, huge dissertation. Anyway, Reutern was Minister of Finance from 1862 to 78, and the two of them actually got along. The only problem from the point of view of the theory was that Reutern, as you can see, was German. He was Lutheran. He invited his nephews and people over for tea and so forth, and part of a whole German community, you know, both of German aristocracy. He didn't marry, didn't have children, but he kept alive this tradition of loyal service to the state, not of course to Russia, to the Russian ethnic group. And his one of his nephews finally published a very, very laudatory biography of those statements, which is a major, in German, of course, which is a major source for the study of Reutern. So on a personal level, Chichov and Reutern could cooperate, but it really undercut the ethnic part. In the last analysis, however, even Reutern remained something of an obtuse bureaucrat. I mentioned a couple of cases where Reutern refused to do what Chichov wanted. And so the Slavophiles had put themselves in this really kind of logical box. You really couldn't criticize the autocracy. You couldn't come out for constitution. You couldn't come out for law. You couldn't come out for the rule of law. All right? There's a little bit of evidence that toward the end of his life, Chichov started to weaken on that point of legality. And we don't know how far he would have gone. I'll make mention specifically of why he did that after the friendship of the person who's been in legal history. But this is, I think, the major problem. If you want the autocrat to do what you want, to carry forth this program, and then the autocrat, you know, gives special subsidies to this French railroad company, you know, and refuses the to let the Muscovites buy the major railroad between Petersburg and Moscow, you have no recourse. You can't say, I'm going to be a liberal democrat and agitate for constitution. That's completely contrary to the whole notion that got you started in the first place. So in that sense, this is pretty much an oxymoron. The interesting thing really is how much Chichov was able to borrow from these capitalist elements and set up actually corporations that could work on a limited scale. Okay? So those are the three major dilemmas that I see: the dilemma of benevolence, the community versus impersonal society, the dilemma of xenophobia. By the way, this turns the Moscow merchants against the Germans in the empire, against the Poles in the empire. It's not just Europe. You've got half the population is in Russia, so you're fighting regional battles within the empire, and the state is trying to satisfy every group of people on the just impossible. Jewish, and then the patriotic effort, founders on this notion of help from the state. If help doesn't come from the state, then there's logical impacts. Okay? So these are the main ideas. By the way, the notion of free trade, which was the key element here for protectionism, big debate was free trade versus protectionism. This is going on in all the major countries. And Chichov read dozens of books. And I have a list. You go through each one in German and French, especially in English. We should remember that The Economist magazine was set up in 1843. To be an economist in the 1840s was to be a proponent of free trade. Pull down these tariffs, everybody specialized. Portuguese can make wine, you know, the English will make whatever the Portuguese need, and we'll buy the wine, and everybody's rich. It's the comparative advantage theory. Right? Some Germans got alarmed by that. Friedrich List, Wilhelm Roscher. Well, Chichov's closest ally to German was actually an economist at Moscow University. His name is Bobson, but he actually wrote a huge translation of Roscher's works, and basically used Roscher to argue against the free trade. But this is very much a current issue. And of course, today, the Economist magazine, which is a very professional organization, propounds what is called globalization. But it's the same argument. You see, it's free trade versus protection going on even now. Okay. And the problem with the government was not only that it blocked the implementation of this program, but actually continued to be very arbitrary in his decision making. Arbitrariness, of course, is the opposite of the rule of law. So these are terms that we throw around, of course, in the Soviet, the Soviet period, but they're very much the key issues of the 1860s and 70s, and I'll come back to that in a minute. Let me make a couple of key points that are factual, just to illustrate what I'm talking about. And all of these have to do with the third point. You can go into a lot of interesting information on these, but dealing with the state is really, really difficult. In 1856, Chizhov, at the very beginning of his journalistic career, actually started publishing his commissions in 1858, a couple years ago. 1856, he'd already decided he was going to do this, and he got together with the merchants, and he wrote a memo to the Ministry of Finance and said, we need a new ministry. We need a Ministry of Trade and Industry, separate from the Ministry of Finance. The Ministry of Finance had a department that dealt with trade. But we need a new ministry. And the minister whose job it is to develop Russian industry. And this ministry needs an advisory council, a manufacturing and commercial council, to be composed of 3 bureaucrats and 8 merchants. And the merchants should be elected. Now that's an excellent example of Glasnost in action. And of course, the council would have only advisory powers. If you want to speak to the Tsar, you would never presume to tell the Tsar what to do or try to cut off his money, which is what happens in the Constitution. But you can imagine what the bureaucrats thought of this policy. This reform was not implemented. Periodically, Chizhov and the Russian merchants would advance this kind of demand for a ministry of trade and industry. Over and over again, they were turned down. The writer himself never backed the idea. Russia finally got the Ministry of Trade and Industry. David's nodding his head. 1905. Yeah. 1905, the government finally got around to putting a ministry in place. And it was staffed by all sorts of bureaucrats, but you can imagine what would have happened if half a century later the government had made that turn toward increasing. The government had its own reasons. Okay. Second example. Chizhov became rich, and he was well known as a very rich man. He was a banker. He set up the first bank in Moscow, the First Mutual Credit Society. He was well known as a very competent, accomplished, successful, not only entrepreneur, but also manager. Those are two very different things in our community society. Reading his diary, reading his papers, we find that he had ideas for 10 other big projects. 3 of them were steamship companies, direct link to London, 5 railroads, 2 big banks, including a bank to be chartered with 25 million rubles in basic capital, which would be a bank of banks. And it would handle large amounts, rediscounting bills of exchange and setting up credit. Two banks. A private bank or banks. Well, these are 10 projects that, and there might have been others, but these are the ones that that got nowhere. The government refused or just showed very little interest in it. And so Chizhov was constantly coming up with new ideas. And in a sense, you could say he was very successful. But if you look at the diary and his papers, you see that he had many, many other projects, 10 of which were really important and were never carried out. The problem was that Voitern was very cautious. In fact, if you're a Tsarist minister, you're very cautious. It's very hard to run this empire and you don't know what might happen. So in any city where there is already a bank, Voitern decreed in 1872, there will be no more banks. The way to avoid speculation and churning of the economy and overheating and people getting exposed to their new loans so that they might lose their collateral and have to default and have a panic. The way to avoid that is just keep the number of banks down. So Chizhov came up with this idea for the Bank of Banks, and just at that point, Reichen was saying, things are getting out of control. No more new banks. In fact, 3 years later, there was a banking crisis, which flowed in from Germany. And Voigtin was there handing out lots of credit to each of the banks, including Tschudolf Bank, which would have failed without it. So in a sense, he owed his much of his success to the arbitrary decisions of Voigtin, but also the caution of the government, his reluctance to commit itself to really major programs also limited his impact. Now, I suppose I'm developing what economists call the counterfactual argument here. It's really hard for historians to do, especially hard to do when you've got only one person involved. But there is a person who is roughly the counterpart of Tschudolf in Japan, in the Meiji period, when the Meiji government simply made extremely sweeping reforms. They opened up social mobility, they changed the army, the navy, they adopted massive education, they sent their students, hundreds of students abroad to study Dutch law, French law, whatever. And there is a person in Meiji Japan, actually, it's a little bit later. His dates are 1840 to 1931. His name is Shibasawa. He started out as a peasant. He was actually lower in social status than Tschudolf. He was a very quick student. He was one of the first students sent abroad by the Meiji government to France to study for a year or two. He came back, he worked in the government, and then he worked in industry, and he worked in government, went back and forth the way we have very rarely in Russia. He set up, I don't know how many dozens of corporations, including the Osaka spinning factory in 1883, which is completely up to date. He was in charge of the Japan Peace Society, so he was one of the anti-militarists during the turn of the century. He came to the United States and met Theodore Roosevelt. He was very well known. He set up a technical school, which is now a university, called Hitotsubashi University. He set up an organization based on patriotic economic activity called the Dragon Gate. And if you type in Dragon Gate on Google, you'll find a nice biography of Shibasawa. From the businessmen saying, before I went into the meeting, I thought about Eiichi Shibasawa and I concentrated my thoughts. So he's a national hero in the Meiji period, whereas Tschudolf is basically forgotten. Tschudolf never got a medal. He was never offered a government job. He was treated in a very respectful way by ministers who lived with him. But the distance, the social distance between the business elite and the bureaucracy was just too great. And so I think that kind of contrast is useful, especially since we know that the Japanese have much farther to go in adopting European legal and institutional structures in Russia. But they overcame that distance and created a much more modern, much more capitalistic system than the Russians. They had a corporate law that allowed corporations to be registered rather than to be confirmed by the state as a matter of impacted into law. For instance, the Tsar's government never did that. Tschudolf did endow a couple of schools. He said in his diary, I don't need the money. I'll give the money away. He always lived in a very frugal way. And so this picture here is the photograph of one of the two schools that he endowed. So when I took a trip down to Boulder in 1986, and I saw the Israeli election, primary government, just before Nelson got the election. Anyway, so there are a couple of technical schools, which were, of course, renamed after the revolution. They now have his name on it. There's a bust of Tschudolf there. But he's very little known, even his own country. And it's a really a great contrast between him and Tschudolf. Okay? Well, that, I think, indicates some of the problems with the dilemmas. Let me just say a few things about the current strategies. There are lots of topics in Russian business history. So when we look for historical research, obviously a whole series of people that deserved to be treated with great deal of care. The Soviets, of course, saw economic history in kind of grand terms without any concern for individuals, or very little concern for themselves. There's a great deal of catching up to do because we left with the Soviets. A lot of this work is, of course, very empirical. It borders on drudgery. You may have to look at it. But Barrington Moreland said that the task of intellectuals is to clean up after the geniuses, to do empirical work that may or may not support the grand theories. There was a lot of theorizing about economic history, about the role of the state, and so on. And that was all based on what the state said and papers of Roy Turn that were published. But when you get into the actual day-to-day minutiae, there's been lots of currents and countercurrents and so on. And, there's a lot to be done in that. And also, key institutions need to be examined. Zhizhov was involved with an institution called the Russian Industrial Society, which is very patriotic, his first meeting in 1867. But there are a lot of these regional and sectoral organizations. The sugar, beet sugar producers had one, and that, they published a memorial volume. There's a very good book, by the way, by Susan McCaffrey on the Association of South Russian Coal and Steel Producers, founded in 1874. That's a first-class study of an organization, a business organization called Trade Association in the U.S. But there are very few studies. Ruth Musa published one, or she wrote one, 800-page dissertation on what we call the Association of Industry and Trade, which started in 1905, which had lots of criticism of the government, something we don't find in the Soviet. She was in failing health, so I took over the job of editing that and bringing it out. But those are two studies. But there are at least a dozen major organizations that need to be studied. What about the problem of generalizing about how, say, business people operate? It is a problem. It's a theoretical problem. Actually, Charles Beard, I think an uncharacteristic Newton caution, said this in 1928. He despaired of explaining political action in terms of economic interest because he said, two persons in the same economic situation and cherishing the same sentiments may differ as to the best plan of action to advance their interests. Their motives may be purely economic and their prejudices identical, but their reasoning divergent. It seems to me that if we study trade associations, as business organizations, we can, I think, be fairly confident that the group is advocating a certain policy and announce that policy works for. This is another way, I think, of building that bridge between sociology and biography to find out what the organizations are, what positions they took. And in a country like Tsarist Russia, where you have a huge, huge geopolitical mass, very many different areas based on climate and resource allocation. There are also very interesting struggles between the business groups here and there. And that work really, I think, is just in its infancy. Now, as for relevance, it seems to me that there's a lot of anti-capitalist thought in the post-Soviet period, and not all of it Soviet. Some of these Slavophile ideals still persist. In fact, a lot of people were disgusted with the Soviet period. In fact, Solzhenitsyn would tell you that the Soviet ideology was just a German ideology imposed by these idiots who need to be thrown out, and then we need to get back to our real Russian Orthodox roots of community and xenophobia. So there are some bases among ethnic Russians for this kind of national insurgents based on ethnic feelings. And a lot of this does persist today. In fact, Zhizhov is the subject of a little biography that just came out by a nationalist kind of right-winger anti-American journalist. She had been studying Slavophiles in the late Soviet period, but there was this kind of nationalist percolating under the Soviet surface, and after the Soviet Union fell, it has kind of gravitated toward this sort of nationalist ideal. And it's very hard to find honest patriotic businessmen in the Russian economy. And so this woman went back to Chizhov and tried to resurrect him in the cause of Slavophile capitalism, with the emphasis on the Slav place. Simon Frank, one of the few philosophers to endorse the idea of the rule of law and constitutional and so forth, once said, this is 1923 in immigration, he noted that most Russians generally believed in the, quote, iniquity of money, unquote, justice and equality had more value than success in business. Russians did not have what he called the worldview of the property owner, that is, a disinterested in their personal belief in sanctity of property, unquote. And if we look at Russian literature, we find Dr. Zhivago, who is a wonderful selfless person. We find the good Dr. Chekhov, over humanity. But to find a businessman who is a model of honesty and good character is very rare. In fact, there are many, many examples of businessmen who are portrayed in a very negative light. As for an understanding of the current system, it's pretty clear that Putin's government is adopting a very arbitrary stance, not so much based on all these ethnic business, but it reminds me a lot of not only the Tsarist government, but the pre-Tsarist government. There's a wonderful new book by John Grace called Russian Oil Supply. Actually, he was one of my students at LSU before he got his PhD in economics. He's an expert on oil supply. And in his book, Russian Oil Supply, which just came out from Oxford this year, he warned that Putin is very much resisting the path of enlightened state sponsorship of capitalism, the kind of capitalist policy that we might find in our favor. Instead, he said Putin is holding out this idea of state interest, arbitrary intervention, and I love this quote. Quote, concentration of authority in the person of the president and empowering personal delegates to fill state and private function is not the Soviet model, but it is Russian. It harks back to medieval Tsars and their boyar retainers, a small class of men who stood both inside and outside court, acting as the eyes, ears, and instruments of the Tsar, with fealty pledged to him personally, unquote. That's a pretty good description of Putin. And so it seems that a lot of these distinctively Russian attitude towards capitalism, toward the outside world, are still with us. And so I hope that this study helps to illuminate the reasons why we don't see the kind of capitalism we see in Germany, France, or in the 19th century. Okay, I'll stop. Any questions? Anything that needs to be defined?
Yes, sir. A couple questions. First, I'm interested in thinking from the period before the Crimean War. There's a lack of entrepreneurial ideas circulating for a lot of reasons. But I know that specifically, Advisor Nicholas I speaks concretely against railway development. Right, against you end up, people end up moving around and you get them in cities and you got a proletariat and a bourgeoisie.
There's too much travel as it is.
Yeah.
And railroads are expensive, so why do we need railroads?
And, well, there's this other one I did from Klemnikel, and there's a vision that they're looking at Great Britain during the Chartist stuff. They're looking at France.
Yeah, 1848. Yeah, there are a million people in the streets.
And they even see this. They even see this with the railway bus in the 1830s in Paris and London. And they've got a picture of what capitalism does, and you don't need that. And so he's got to be aware of that argument that because the Slavophiles make themselves. You were citing their suspicion of social contract, let alone business contract. And this idea that is pretty widespread by the 1850s among left-wing critics of capitalism, that it uproots populations, it atomizes them, puts people against one another. What's the move he makes to argue that this isn't going to happen in Russia?
Most of the people who are interested in modern ideas in Russia are socialists. They have no use for capitalism. They skip right over to utopian socialism. Best example is Herzen, a phenomenally educated person in biology, goes to Europe, hates Europe, and develops his vision of a socialist community. I think the war is what changes.
Well,
because they couldn't even supply the troops in the Crimea. The mail came from England to the Crimea for the British troops faster than it got from Russia to the Russian troops in the Crimea. And of course, they had better equipment, better ships. And so I think everybody realizes that railroads are needed partly for military reasons, because we need to ship the troops to the front. But purely military lines are very expensive. So if you can get railroads that will help to export grain, if you can build up some cash, and also give Russian workers a way to have constructive work, and you can put your engineers to work, and put your money to work, all in a patriotic motive, because everyone's phenomenally angry against Austria.
No, and I understand that. I didn't frame my question specifically enough, because when people hear that story, like in the 1880s and 90s, Witte will make the same argument, and he'll be confident enough in state control to be able to manage the process.
It's too expensive.
But a guy like Chizhov, he's got to be aware that there's, because I'm just trying to figure out, how does he argue that the industrialization, even at the relatively modest pace as envisioned in the Raytheon reforms, then, how privately funded railways will not create these atomized, individualized.
Because he will choose Russian managers, Russian engineers. At one point, one of his top administrators was hired away serving the state railroads. And he said, the bureaucrats are after me to hire a Pole. Now, some of the engineers, Polish engineers are pretty good. But if you put a Pole in charge, all he'll do is hire other Poles. And they love to build a big bureaucracy. It's going to be too expensive. So we need Russian. We can trust Russia. He was going to trust his Russian merchants not to treat these thousands of workers badly. There'd be enough kind of Orthodox feeling of the Russian Orthodox law within the community. And that would finesse the issue of atomization and proletarization.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The Russian working class will not become a proletariat. Who wouldn't become a working class? We'll be brothers in Christ, having our holidays, and a lot of the paternalism was overrated. The latrines were dirty, and the daycare center was not. There are other ways for the government to step in and actually create laws against child labor and female labor. But the myth was that the Russian will treat his workers, not like a campaign, those people can't be trusted, but in the Moscow area, from Kostroma down to Kaluga, all these people are going to be taking good care of their workers, because they're, I'm on the bank board, these people are on the bank board, these people are good, solid Russian people. In fact, many of the merchants came from the peasants.
Sure, well, that's
the idea is that they love the people that they came from, but in fact, in other words, didn't ask. So it was all a kind of a ethnic myth. It didn't bother him.
Yeah.
He finessed that issue. Russia will have a separate path.
Well, you have to. The only other one I'll ask is, it seems there's a subtext in this story, right, that plugs into arguments that you see for the reign of Nicholas II, that there was a chance to form what we would call something like a civil society or a public sphere of where you had an autonomous social sphere, sort of like Aksakov, his buddy, envisions in that letter to Alexander II in 1859. And it seems that Constantine. Yeah, I'm sorry. But the story you're telling is, in many ways, if we look at it organizationally, is the same thing that the Zemstvos go through from their formation until the late 1860s.
Counter-reform.
Even the Alexander II regime tends to, once these things sort of blossom in the first blush of glassness, by the late 1860s, there are universities.
Censorship.
Yes.
Censorship is very, very nice.
Now, is Chizhov aware of this in these larger systemic
He has a wonderful letter, a very nasty letter he wrote to the Minister of Education, who was in charge of censorship. And he just blasted himself. I was not being disloyal when I pointed all the problems in Russia. And you consider me some kind of a subversive person. We need more open discussion. But the government never, even Goldin, who's regarded as a liberal, was very, very nasty towards Chichov. Chichov was up for editorship of one of Aksakov's journals, and Goldin said, this man can't be trusted. All he does is find things to criticize. Chichov really got angry and went on. Very, very. Part of his attitude is one of personal worth and independence. And just like Herzen, he thought, I'm a member of the champion. I will not be pushed around. I'm not one of these illiterate merchants. I will be taken seriously as an individual. And so he has that kind of sense of personal worth that allows him to speak up. But certainly, he was very angry. At one point, he began to develop a little bit of a critique of autocracy itself. He was very angry at what weakening of legal norms. And he had a friend from the university days who was a scholar of Russian legal history. And he began to dabble a little bit in legal history.
Who was that?
Polyanov.
Okay, yeah.
Dmitry Polyanov. And he reviewed Polyanov's book. And he found that the people had been treated very poorly, that the law of the code of 1849 had done nothing to help merchants. So he's on the way to legality a little bit. And at one point he became disgusted with the Tsar. The Tsar's train pulled in the station and the low families in the palace so he looked around the train. So he opened the door and here's this lavish compartment, beautiful oak wood door, and a little tiny cubicle for the valet with the lackeys. And he blew his stack, treating him like a dog. Here's this man, he's just a man. Why is he acting like the son of a, Oriental despot. And then he opened the door to the Tsarina's water closet. And there was moire silk on the walls. And, oh, such luxury. But he never completely renounced it. But he had a very low opinion of Alexander as a person. But he never really took that final step to say, we need a constitution. He was disenchanted with constitution. What we have in France and in Britain. Country. So he was really kind of caught in his own logical bind.
The fascinating talk, particularly what I usually hear as primary source of the diary, unknown diaries. Particularly what I appreciate was the comparison with Japan, another entrepreneurial history of a country basically starting from nothing. As you rightly underlined, even more difficult conditions than Russia. Wasn't there an answer to what you call the dilemma of Chir in the path of which the man mentioned by David 3 decades later, namely Sergei Vitsky, the most probably important statesman of Russia? I'm glad that Solzhenitsyn is not here because he would have jumped at me and said, what? Peter, German, Stolüte was the greatest statesman of Russia. I saw a couple of weeks in Germany a document of him on Stolüte, Solzhenitsyn, and he was lecturing Putin, who came to a private visit to his house, modernized villa in Moscow suburb, and Putin was piously listening as Solzhenitsyn was telling him about the greatness of Stolüte. A personal example, perhaps, but why not Witte, to specify what I had in mind. When Witte had a similar background than Chijon, he rose to his position as a minister through railroads, as an entrepreneur, as a banker.
As a manager. He never got into the
crisis. But he probably saw the dilemma of Russian autocracy, of Russian power, the Kazanya. And decided to go right in the center, to become the heir of the Tsar.
Certainly, if there had been a Witte in 1858, he might have appointed Chichov, head of the new ministry of part of the ministry of trade and industry. I don't think there's anyone like Witte in the government. And even Dvorkin was completely honest, very capable, is very, very cautious. And when the war with Turkey comes along, last the whole finance experience and have to wait another 2 decades to.
I'm not suggesting that this is
so, so where is the veto? I think it's not there. There's no one like
it. Well, you're not going to get veto out of the ring.
Yeah, and, even veto would not have been appointed by Alexander. I agree. The great reforms are, you know, really the opportunity. And certainly, at the same time, the Meiji government is seizing that opportunity. But the Russian government kind of just muddled through, put out a few very minor reforms. I mean, not the great reforms, you know, the minor reforms. It was able to survive for another 2 decades. But I agree, there's a great opportunity here, but it just isn't the political will. This is why I put primary responsibility on the state. We have this kind of vicious circle, weak entrepreneurship and powerful state. But the merchants are not going to break the circle. The government has to break the circle by taking decisive action to open the way.
And there's not a single ruler from Nicholas I, from Alexander I on, that would be persuaded by what we would call political economic arguments of how you generate the utility as a product of national wealth. They still see.
We are the biggest country. We are the richest country. Let them come to us. We have these great distances. Nobody can invade us. You know, we show them the way we show them home. And of course, they're constantly working with this budget that's under stress. They're always underfunded. The railroads are expensive. It's very.
Does Chizhov object to the joint venture railways that spring up in the southwest provinces in the 1870s, early 1870s?
Which joint venture?
The southwest railway I'm thinking of. That's where Vita gets his start in the biz, is he's tariff rates. He manages and calculates
right.
The tariff rates.
Towards,
it's all
no,
rare
south,
money.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
His last real project is to get Savo Mamontov, who's now known as an art patron, into the Donetsk Railroad. But no, he has nothing but contempt for state. You know, they don't build graded crossings. There's too much waste. This whole bureaucracy. Nobody takes responsibility. You need, you know, proper. Well, you need honest businessmen who are Russians to do this work on a patriotic scene.
But this is in the western half of Russia, the eastern half, east of the Urals.
No,
it's much larger.
Yeah, he had a plan for a railroad to Central Asia.
There's no private.
Well,
he was looking for military needs.
He was looking for a privately funded railroad before Central Asia.
I know you've done a lot of work with the history of Russian corporations in your earlier work. And you said today that there was no general corporation law for corporations in Russia under the Tsar. And I wondered if what your man thought of this. You said he was involved certainly in his own corporations, and one of Weber's elements is public sale of shares, which of course requires you to have a corporation.
Yeah, he admired the British system where you have one law, and then you register companies under that law, rather than having a separate law for each corporation.
Exactly, right. But what I'm wondering is, I mean, by the end of the century, certainly every major country had a general incorporation. From the 70s on.
And Japan had it in 1992.
Did he make any kind of, did he and his allies in their conversations with the government officials ever make any sustained arguments that there were, that, you know, that on, say, competitive grounds that they needed to permit free incorporation?
I don't think he mentioned that. Mm-hmm. And I think that was pretty much a secondary issue for him. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a procedural kind of issue. I'm sure he would have welcomed it.
I just have to pass along one little fact that I've learned recently about the U.S. and Germany, which I sort of knew, but I never like quite distilled down to this before. That work on the U.S. and Germany, and corporations in particular, right now. And the Germans and the French, of course, moved to general incorporation around 1871 and 1867, respectively. But the terms in which they did it were very different. And the data point that illustrates this difference between the United States and Germany is in the year, I forget the year exactly, I think it's 1914. In the US, there were at least, there's no complete tally, but there were at least 22,000 corporations created. And in Germany, I believe the number is 186. Created. It's just an astounding.
Well,
and I assume that what you're talking
yeah.
about.
In Russia in 1914, there were 2,167 corporations.
In existence.
In existence. And another 100 or so forms. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So they really kept it.
Right.
But that was still active committee of ministers right down in 1914, wasn't it? The
yeah.
Every,
no, they do it in batches.
Signed off
yeah.
on the
yeah.
details.
Yeah,
yeah.
They do it in batches, but still, you have to get this, it had to become a law of the empire.
Mm-hmm.
It was chartered. That's control.
I guess I'm just a little surprised that there wasn't some more active lobbying or more visible lobbying.
There was.
Well, the Moscow, your guys would. The stock exchange guys were interested.
Yeah. I chronicled that whole story. There are a series of committees to study the question.
Uh-huh.
And each time it comes to that, we can't do it now. And it actually came up under working. Mm-hmm. Time and again, maybe 5-6 times, they looked into it. Are we out of time?
Okay.
There still
time
left to record, if anybody else has a question. Did he actually manage to build a railroad? Yeah, he built the railroad from Moscow to the holiest site of Russian Orthodoxy, which is the Trinity Monastery. And he called the railroad the Trinity Railroad. And then he extended it farther north, up to Yaroslavl, and then Sava Mamontov, the great art patron, who was his protege, sent it up to Archangel, and during World War I, there was a radical journalist in Dorosevich who praised Salomonov for building this railroad so that the supplies could come from the Allies into Russia without being followed up by the German fleet. So yeah, he ran one railroad, he founded a major bank and a mutual credit society, he ran another railroad, but my point was that he had a lot of other plans. Yeah, he became very wealthy in the businesses that he had, because he ran them very, very strictly with his firm on thrift and good profit.
Any final questions? If not, thank you very much.